Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Broadway Podcast Network presents Giants in the Sky, How Sondheim and Lapine Went into the Woods, with me, Ben Rimmelauer. Today's guest, Eric Stern, co-musical director at the Old Globe.
Once upon a time.
Eric Stern served as co-musical director alongside Paul Gemignani on the Old Globe production of Into the Woods. He had previously replaced Gemignani as conductor on the original Broadway production of Sunday in the Park with George. He was also musical director and or conductor on the Roundabout Theater's production of Follies and the Tyne Daly revival of Gypsy, in addition to Broadway productions of Shrek, Xanadu, Parade, Candide, Once Upon a Mattress, The King and I, Showboat, Carousel, The Will Rogers Follies, Legs Diamond, Rags, and The Most Happy Fella, as well as the national tour of Thoroughly Modern Millie. He has concertized and recorded with such diverse artists as Don Upshaw, Audra McDonald, Mandy Patinkin, Barbara Cook, and Betty Buckley, among many others. He is a frequent guest conductor for the BBC and has led some of the world's best orchestras, including the Boston Pops, the London Symphony Orchestra, the Cleveland Orchestra, the Chicago Symphony, and the New York Pops. He is the winner of an Emmy for PBS's The Music of Julie Stein and two Gramophone Awards for I Wish It So and OK. Eric is a professor of composition, piano, and voice at the Berklee College of Music. Brilliant, Eric Stern, my old friend. So happy to chat with you. I want to start by asking you the same question that I've asked everybody, which is, do you remember when you first became aware that there was this fairy tale mashup musical Into the Woods by Sondheim and Lapine?
I think it was Gemignani who first mentioned it to me. There may have been... Now, you know, we're talking about the mists of time here.
Yes.
Especially for one as old as I am. Yeah. I can barely remember what happened yesterday. But it seems to me that it was Paul who first mentioned it. I think when it came on the schedule, Paul realized he was going to have some problems with other commitments.
This is for the production at the Old Globe.
At the Old Globe when it first started. I actually had nothing to do with the Broadway production. By the time it went to Broadway, I was gone.
And so is this before the workshop at Playwrights Horizons in June of 86 or after that?
Yes, it was after. I'm sorry, it was after it. It was, I forget, I'm trying to remember the name of the rehearsal space we were in Chelsea.
What's it, the Westbeth Theater Center?
Yes, that's exactly what it was. Thank you. I was trying to pull that out of the fog of memory. It was at that point. So I may have known about it beforehand, but that was the first time I became aware that it was actually happening.
And so just on that note of the Westbeth, I know that I've heard from some NYU students at the time, now they're, you know,
they're grandparents too.
But they at the time had responded to a post on a bulletin board to go be sort of blocking dummies, like chess pieces, for Lapine prior to starting the rehearsals for San Diego, but also at the Westbeth. And I guess he was making the decision whether or not he could do Into the Woods in San Diego without a choreographer. And I guess he was happy with what he did with these NYU students and then decided to do San Diego without a choreographer. And then whatever went down in San Diego, they decided to have a choreographer for Broadway. But were you part of that process with those students?
Am I crazy? Wasn't Lars Lubavitch, I guess... Was Lars involved in Into the Woods in the Old Globe?
My understanding is that he was not, and he came for Broadway.
Right. You're absolutely right. Thank you for clearing that up for me. First of all, it doesn't surprise me that James was doing the chess piece thing. A lot of directors, and actually some of my favorite directors, start out that way. I mean, do that. I never met any of the stand-ins. I wasn't aware of that process. But that's interesting. It sounds logical that he would do that.
And so Paul brought you. Well, why don't we just get a little background? Because I think this was, where were you in your career and as a Sondheim fan? Well, you know, what was the context in your life?
I try very hard not to use the word career because it just makes me giggle. you know, I was lucky enough to work a lot of the time. I had just finished taking over for Paul for Sunday in the Park. And Paul had to run and do Grind, which was going to be a huge hit. And he handed me the baton and said, take care of my baby. I've never forgotten that moment. And I have stories about that mentorship too, which if we ever get around to it, I'd love to tell.
Yeah, but, for sure.
But anyway, he left me with that. And I conducted the next year of Sunday in the Park with George.
Wow. And so Broadway. Was this, was there a replacement cast already in
no,
there?
No, I think I had the tail end of Mandy and Bernadette. Mandy and I have always been friends. We've known each other forever.
Mm. So
we were, I think we were friends before then. But I might be wrong. I don't remember. But no, and then I went with George and Marianne Plunkett. And George, what am I talking about?
Howard.
Howard. And then, can't think of his name.
He's a Harry.
Lovely actor. Yes, Harry thank Groner. You, Harry. Lovely yes. actor, yeah. And Paul Ford and I broke those people in happily.
Yeah.
But the funny thing about that story is that Grind evidently was not the big hit that everybody
evidently,
thought.
Yeah.
And I got a call from Geminiani. I hope he won't mind me saying this, saying, can I have my show back? Which is not legal. I mean, you know, he gave it away. And what did I say? I said, yes, of course, you can have your show back. And he said, well, I'm coming back on Sunday, which is the last show of the week. So listen, you owe me a show. You know, you're going to get paid for the first day I'm back. I'll call you. You do it. You'll sub in for a show. And I thought, fine. And months went by. I never had a thought about it.
Yeah.
And suddenly I get a call saying, are you free Saturday afternoon? I'm going like, yeah. He says, you're right. You're doing Sunday. Click. And I went, shoot, I haven't even thought about that show. And I start, my knees started knocking together. And I walked into that pit scared out of my, I've never been more scared about anything in my life. And whoever the George was at that time said, white, whatever the cue is, a blank page of canvas. And my arm went, do-do-do-do-do. My arm knew it. I looked like it was a disembodied attachment to someone else. And I just stayed out of the way and I let my body conduct it. Anyway, that story is always fascinating.
This might be an idiotic question. So please, you know, feel free to, feel free to judge. But, you know, I've heard a lot of people talk as pianists about the extra challenge of playing Sondheim and the workout their fingers get and, you know, all those, what is it, 16th notes. And, you know, it is the same true as a conductor?
Yes, but obviously for different reasons. You're not worried about the eighth notes. You're worried about the cueing. You're worried about the tempo variations. You're worried about catching things on stage. I mean, when I took over Sunday in the Park with George, I sat in the back and watched every single move and memorized how the stage moved because I knew that's what was important.
Yeah.
I didn't spend any time with the cast on them because the cast on them is something else. You know, it's not the same thing. And as far as that goes, Into the Woods is, especially in its present form, is twice as complicated as Sunday. All these teeny little, you know, critical teeny little cues. So it's a matter of you can't lose concentration.
Yeah.
But I was just amazed that, like I said, that the minute I started thinking about what I was doing, that one show I did back at Sunday, it fell apart. So I just said, okay, I can't think about this.
Yeah.
I just watched my arms do the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, every show has its own challenge. As you know, you must know. In every show is a little different. But anyway, so... And I had known Steve and worked with Steve long before that as well. I did his Pacific Overtures at oh my God, there goes my brain.
Was it City Opera?
No, the off-Broadway at the, oh my gosh, you're going to want to trim this out. Starts with a P. It's a Promenade.
Oh, right.
I'm going to say that again.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did the off-Broadway revival at Promenade, which, and I had also done several things at York Theater that Steve had seen. So we'd known of each other.
Oh, were those like the Equity Library productions at the York?
I did one Equity Library production that he didn't come to, thank God. But I did several at York Theater.
Mm.
He saw my little night music. He saw my Anyone Can Whistle. He saw a few things. When I say my, I mean the ones I participated in.
Yeah.
Wow. So they kind of, I was a known quantity. And the great call from Geminiani was, by the way, have you noticed the problem is not getting me to talk? The problem is getting me to shut up. Okay. The call I got from Geminiani was just pure Geminiani. He called me and said, look, I can't make the first rehearsals. I can't make any of the rehearsals in New York. But then when he goes to the Old Globe, I can take over. I can't do an impression, but that's roughly it. And then I can't conduct the last 5 weeks or 4 weeks or so. So I was doing the beginning and the end.
Yeah.
And he said to me, look, I don't want an assistant. And you don't want an assistant. So how about when you're there, you're the music director. When I'm there, I'm the music director. And I'm thinking to myself, that's never going to work.
Yeah.
And it worked perfectly. Another example of how Paul's intuition is so dead on, even when it seems not logical. It
Yeah.
worked perfectly. You know, he didn't change much of what I did, and I certainly didn't change much of what he did when I came back. It was like, it was kind of seamless.
But so you were building it, though. I mean, you were putting it on the cast. And
I put it on his feet. Yes, I did. I taught it to the cast. I watched the numbers come in. As you know, Steve is famous for not having a complete score when you go into
the Yeah.
And I watched numbers come in. I don't know if you know who she is, long gone Matilda Pincus from Chelsea Music, copyist. And she pulled me in. She pulled me into Chelsea Copy, and she showed me how the copies were generated and how the copyists work and how they try to preserve page turns on the page turns in the page. And I would go and collect every piece as it was coming off the press, and she would basically walk me through it. Very sweet that she took me under her arm.
I mean, I know famous, you know, famously, No One Is Alone came late yes. in that process, I think already in San Diego.
But you know what came in the rehearsal room at Westbeth?
What's that?
No More.
Wow.
Unbelievable. He came in, we were in the middle of rehearsal in the second or third week, whatever. And he came in and he played that song. And I swear you've never heard silence like that afterwards. No one could talk. No one could move. It was a seminal moment for me. I mean, it's burned, etched in my memory.
Do you remember? I believe that the song as it existed then was longer, where there was more for George Coe as the mysterious man to sing. Does that?
I believe so. And actually, there's one theme in it that I used in a scene change that I, you know, music directors constantly do little things and Steve's fine with it, you know. So I wrote a scene change, and in fact there was a little bit of a wisp of that theme that's no longer in the show, but it's in that 6-bar scene change.
What does that sound like? And which scene change would that be? Now I want to look for it.
It's the one right before No More.
Oh, lovely.
I forget what it's called. It's got a, you know, it's named after the cue line, which they often do with little cues. They name it for the line that comes before it.
Yes, yes. And, starting from that point, I mean, obviously things have to get cut. Shows can't be 5 hours long. But that certainly, I mean, you know, it's a pretty common thing to cherish the song No More. I mean, whatever someone's opinion about Into the Woods, that's such a astonishing piece of writing. And it seems to me like a loss to not have the fuller version of that. Am I just wrong? And, you know,
I think it still makes an emotional impact. As a matter of fact, I can't really remember the first version.
Yeah.
And it's to my everlasting shame that I don't have my original, those original piano vocals from Matty Pincus. They disappeared somewhere in my many moves.
To my everlasting shame as well. What else do you remember about the early incarnation of the material?
Well, I don't know if this counts, but I fell in love with Joanna Gleason.
Yeah.
I mean, that woman's timing, that woman's sense of humor and character and warmth and all of those things. And she and Chip were wonderful together.
Although that was Chip. I'm sorry. You had Chip already in San
Diego. Yeah, we had Chip.
So let me ask you about them, because I mean, you know, those are such iconic performances to us. I mean, I always say that the legacy of Into the Woods, unlike most shows where you have to compete with an original cast recording, so many people grew up on that video and know every line in the book by heart. And Joanna, particularly, those line readings are like kind of inescapable.
And you miss them when they're not there, don't you?
You miss them when they're not there, yeah. And, you know, it's not fair. I've seen wonderful actors do, you know, really terrific performances as the Baker's Wife, and it just kind of can't escape that shadow for me, and I know for many people.
For me,
was that something that arrived fully formed, or did you see that get developed?
Well, once again, I think my memory is not very good about that.
Yeah.
I remember instantly going, oh, my God, this is perfect. And also, you know, I call them the Eve Arden lines. They're not the Eve Arden roles. They're not really, but that sort of dry wit. That's the same as, you know, Charlotte the Countess in the Little Night.
Yes, music. Absolutely.
You know, it's that kind of, that kind of dry, subtle wit that just was perfectly matched for her.
Yeah.
And I also love the evolution of that relationship, you know, for the Baker finally realizing that, oh yeah, she's smarter than I am, or mm-hmm. I, or, maybe even no, I need her. And that evolution was, it was wonderful. And by the way, I'm still angry as all get out that they killed her at the in the second half. I think everybody is.
Because I know in the workshop after San Diego, they had experimented with different endings where she didn't die or died in different ways. Did that happen at the Old Globe also?
Again, I don't recall. I'm so sorry. I don't think so. I think at the Old Globe, we were, well, let's put it this way. If it did, it happened during the time that I wasn't there. Because remember, the weeks we spent at Westbeth were about getting the damn thing on its feet.
Yes,
you know,
yeah.
And there's not much else you can do at that point.
Right. So, okay, then leaving the witch aside, because I want to get deep into the witch.
I'd love to talk about
it. But with the rest of the cast, there were, I'm curious, you know, for example, George Coe, I mean, a Broadway veteran who was playing the mysterious man, which at that
time. And a Sondheim veteran.
And a Sondheim veteran. The mysterious man, which at that time was a double track with Cinderella's father.
Right.
You know, did that seem like a problem area in the cast that needed to be replaced for Broadway? It's sort of surprising to me that he wasn't kept.
Well, here's the question. Was he not kept, or did he have other things to do, or was he not thrilled Good with question. The role? Or, I mean, you know, I can speak quickly to Ellen in the sense that that was an instance where, in fact, she obviously wanted to stay and was let go.
Yeah.
And it was kind of abrupt, actually. My question is, did they have Bernadette in their pocket already? Did they know that was going to happen?
You know, people are always asking me if I'm on Ozempic, and let me tell you, I do not mind them asking me that. But I'm not on Ozempic. They especially ask me that when they see me eating dessert or desserts or all the crap I eat when I'm out. But my secret is that when I'm home, when I'm by myself, I'm eating Factor. Factor sends me restaurant-quality meals that are ready to heat and eat whenever I am. No prepping, no cooking, no cleanup except for, like, my fork. And now you can enjoy Factor meals, too. Go to factormeals.com/giantsinthesky50 and use code giantsinthesky50 to get 50% off. That's code giantsinthesky50 at factormeals.com/giantsinthesky50 to get 50% off. Well, I don't think they had Bernadette in their pocket because they did that workshop with Betty immediately before Broadway. And I mean, I'm getting so many different stories from had Bernadette in their pocket to Bernadette wasn't available, or they would have had her, or that it wasn't a big enough part for Bernadette, or they always knew they were going to make the part bigger, so that wasn't the issue. I really can't get a sort of straight truth.
And I don't know the answer either. I do know that I enjoyed Ellen Foley. I enjoyed watching her work. And I do remember the time when she was informed that she wasn't going to be continuing with the show. And I just watched her sort of blinking back the surprise.
When was that time? Where was that instance?
Again, this is a story that may not reflect well on a member of the creative team that I actually very, very fond of. But I think James let it slip, perhaps unintentionally. I can't really speak to it. Was I there? Did I see it? Boy, you know, you when you run over things in your memory, you tend to redefine them as you rerun them in your head. I seem to remember him saying, look, I'm not going to give you any more notes because you're not going to be joining the New York company. In some form, she was told that.
In San Diego.
Yeah. That was definitely in San Diego.
And that's again, fascinating.
The James that I am so incredibly fond of, and I've always been an admirer, would not have done that today. But I think back then he had so much to handle, and it was just his way of saying, I can't really concentrate on you now.
Yeah.
So I mean, I don't think it was ill meant, but
when you witnessed that moment, was the feeling like, holy shit? Or was it like, yeah, it seemed clear that that would be.
No, it was definitely the former. It was a holy shit moment.
I mean, and was that to do with, just a matter of sort of marquee value, or did it seem like it was about the creative choices in her performance?
I would imagine it's probably a little bit of both, but I have no insight into it. That's just a guess.
You know, and then as far as her performance, I mean, it's, I mean, first of all, she had a lot less material than the witch ultimately had. I mean, if I'm understanding correctly what was in the script in San Diego, she had the Greens rap in the opening number, and she had that song Boom Crunch.
Boom Crunch, which you replaced with Last Midnight
for a long time before Last Midnight. But she did not have Children Will Listen. No. And she did not have the Stay With Me ballad she sings to Rapunzel.
Which, by the way, is one of my favorite moments in the show.
Exquisite.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it, whether they had that in mind or not to beef up the role, they certainly had not done that yet. And,
but having that part be a star turn is an advantageous decision, ultimately.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I haven't really gotten clarity yet on whether that was the intention yet at that point. And because also Betty, I don't know, maybe you can shed light on this. Betty Buckley, who did that workshop right before the Broadway rehearsal process, you know, a matter of weeks, not months,
yeah.
Had also done the Playwrights Horizons workshop prior to San Diego. And my guess was that she didn't go to San Diego because she was doing song and dance on Broadway. Because since they went back to her afterwards, and maybe that was the intention, you know. I also still don't know the timing. There's famous auditions of like Patti LuPone and Petula Clark and a few other people, Eartha Kitt, but I don't know if that was after San Diego or during, you know, after the workshop or whatever. But one thing that Betty Buckley talked about in a book she was interviewed in called Nothing Like a Dame by Eddie Shapiro.
Yeah.
She talked about having artistic differences with James Lapine during the workshops, and that she saw the relationship between the witch and Rapunzel as an abusive mother, which I'm kind of just like, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But as she portrays it, that Lapine saw it as a lesbian relationship, which at first struck me as Betty either describing it wrong or remembering it wrong or even misunderstanding him at the time, or maybe he meant something sort of allegorical or something. But then I remembered that the witch is not Rapunzel's mother, and that I thought, well, maybe it was intended to be like the judge and Joanna and Sweeney Todd, and that, you know, the Rapunzel's like her ward. And on some scratchy bootleg videos of the Old Globe production, there does seem to be some of that coloring Ellen Foley's performance. So do you remember that being the take at that phase in the process?
No, I'm soaking all this up and loving hearing it for the first time. This is fascinating to me. I should be interviewing you, Ben.
Okay. Well, then tell me then what other things that you do remember about that time.
Let's see. What else do I remember? I remember when the company packed up to leave the rehearsal studio.
Mm.
And it was almost like when you leave an apartment and you do what they call a broom clean, you know,
yeah,
before the next renter takes it. And I was standing there looking out, just staring into space, and it was pretty empty. And I didn't notice that James was behind me or next to me. And he turned to me and he looked at me and he said, "It must be really tough to see this go on without you." And I thought that was an amazing thing for him to say.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, "You're hurting right now, aren't you?" And I didn't think I was showing it. And
yeah.
I wanted to give him a hug. He was right. It's very hard to put so much of yourself into something and then watch it go away.
Yeah.
But then I got to come back.
Yeah.
When I came back, Tunic was there. I got to watch that process, and I saw how much how much it had evolved, and I got to watch Geminiani do some shows and basically sort of watch what was going on and then take it over.
Mm.
If I can tell you, I have three minor inputs into the show.
I would love to know that.
Two of them are totally ridiculous and stupid, and one of them I consider comically rather important. So my two musical contributions are very minor and very funny. One of them is that scene change I told you about. The other one is the music when Rapunzel lets down her hair, which Jonathan didn't even orchestrate. It's like a cellist going, "Be-do-do-da-da-do-do-da." You know, yeah, he took one of the themes and just made a loop out of it, dropping down chromatically, because there was no music to drop the hair down. But this is my contribution to Into the Woods. At one point in San Diego, Steve came up to me, and I was not expecting this. He said, look, because the number had ended, you know, that opening number is like 5 years long. And it's to the end, and it ended into the woods and out of the woods and home before dark. Boom. That's the way it ended. And he said, how do I make that button bigger? And I don't know where this came from, but I said, don't make the button bigger. Make the note before it longer. Into the woods and out of the woods, and home before dark.
Wow.
Because I knew that home before dark, boom, had to stay the way it was because it was flippant.
Yeah.
It was like it had to retain that quality of flippancy, if that is even what it is. I'm just trying to find a word.
Yeah.
But I don't know where that came from. I'm so proud in retrospect that I thought of that.
I'm proud of you too. I love that.
And as a matter of fact, on Broadway, they even doubled it from what I had suggested.
More is more. That's incredible.
Exactly. So that is my contribution. That when I die, that's what I've left Broadway. That's what it
is. I love it. What about other things that had changed, like when you got to San Diego to take the baton? Do you remember what things you were like, oh, wow, that's not how it was?
No, I just don't have command of those details
anymore. Yeah.
Also, my problem is I've done the show since.
Right. So you remember the final Broadway version. Yeah.
Right now, the version that everybody knows is the version I know.
Yeah. What about this? Is it true that Rapunzel, because I know it was Kay McLelland as Rapunzel in San Diego, that her little, what do you call it, like vocalese was down the octave?
No, I don't remember that. I do know that motivically, it's one of the most, it's a very important motive that runs through the show in so many ways. I mean, that, is when you look, dun, 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 low. I mean, it's all over the score.
Yeah.
No, I don't remember. By the way, who knew that Lauren Mitchell would turn into be a big producer on Broadway?
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. It's
like. And marry Michael David.
Hmm?
And marry Michael David.
Lost on me.
She and Michael David have been married for years now.
Oh, she married. I thought you said marry Michael David. Like,
oh, no. Yeah, like Mary Mitchell Gordon Campbell. Murray. Yeah.
You're referring to Mary Mitchell Campbell.
No, sorry. I should have said marry
Michael Yes, David. Absolutely. No, exactly. Well, you know, I mean, there were a couple other marriages, Into the Woods marriages.
Yes.
Bob Westenberg and Kim Crosby.
At least they went on a date during the show. I mean, Lauren said that she and Michael didn't even like barely meet during Into the Woods on Broadway. And let's see, any other sort of like, you know, cast gossip from the San Diego run?
I'm trying to think who I really, whether I remember any cast gossip. You know, I'm always the last one to figure out that people are dating or whatever word you want to use.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always being told, well, you know, they're together. I said, no, really? I'm trying to think. I don't know. I can't think of anything. I do... Oh, now I'm fumbling. I don't really recall anything. No, you know, it's funny. My memory is so funny that I've even replaced, what was her name? I've replaced Lou Anne Ponce with Danielle in my mind.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I see the same. I love the fact that Little Red Riding Hood has bloodlust. That she she'll cut your throat. I just
Fantastic.
Love that. Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
So many wonderful things about it. Have you noticed that, well, two things. Number one, in Lapine stuff, well, especially in Into the Woods, the women are the only smart ones.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the smartest character is the baker's wife and then perhaps the witch.
Yeah.
But everybody else is kind of like in a funny place. And in the end, who takes charge and who becomes the mother? And, you know, it's Little Red Riding Hood grows. She evolves.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting. I also said to Lapine, and here again, maybe unintentionally patting myself on the back, but at one point I pulled him aside in the old in San Diego. And I said, you know, it's really amazing that both these shows that I've worked on that are yours have created completely original worlds that don't exist. It's like, it's not a musical that takes place in, Romania, or that, is like New York City. You've invented completely new places. And what also fascinates me about those two pieces, because I consider them sister musicals, is the sense of the first act and the second act.
Oh, God, yeah.
And I think, people who decry that, I think that's kind of their strength. I mean, I think in Sunday in the Park with George, you need to feel alienated at the top of the second act in order to understand the second half of the second
That's
act.
right.
It's important. And I think that likewise in Into the Woods, you need that reflective thing to, to make the point that the play is making. So
Totally.
I just think it's very interesting. I think both pieces are very similar in certain ways.
Did you, I know that you've done other productions of Into the Woods over the years. Have there been things that have come to you about the material that you hadn't realized in that initial interaction?
Yeah, I think the sense of who, as I was saying before, I think who evolves, who changes, is interesting to me. And because I now sort of teach Sondheim in a sense, a part of what I do, I've been thinking about that a lot. I mean, it's interesting to me that, I mean, not to go back to Sunday, but a lot of people really don't like the George character because they think he's a misogynist, or they think he's, and to my mind, George is just like in the zone. He's like maybe you meet a little on the spectrum. And I mean, I love the fact that the only person he ever opens up his heart to is a dog. I mean, I think that's very interesting. But you know who evolves? You know whose evolution that first act is? It's Dot. Starts out as a spoiled charge and spoiled child, and ends up as a complete woman. And I think that watching the trajectory in Into the Woods is equally as interesting. Everybody has a moment where there's a crucible, there's a something that happens in their life that is dangerous and awful, and they come out of it a different person and or a better person. And unfortunately, when that happens to the baker's wife, she immediately dies. That happens sometimes, I guess. We never know when it's coming. I loved Merle Louise's giant. It was so much fun seeing this little lady. Oh, and I forgot Barbara Brynn. What a treasure she is. What a her again, her timing, her inflections are indelibly stuck in my mind.
Totally. In both those shows.
Yeah, in both of those shows, absolutely.
Well, I'd love to know more about the relationship with Geminiani if you feel like getting into that.
Well, oh, sorry, that was my computer blinging. Yeah, well, there are people who dismiss him because in certain levels of minutia, in terms of theoretical knowledge and other aspects, they consider him untaught or uneducated. Paul is brilliant about, well, in two ways. I think that, well, many ways, but in one way, the way Hal Prince was, the idea of constantly, I mean, you think you have a rehearsal period that's like 6 weeks and it seems so luxurious. But Paul and Hal together were brilliant at moving forward. Don't stop. Etch the whole thing out, then look at it. And I've been in so many situations where someone tinkers with something so minutely and so almost obsessively without before moving on, and it's just Paul has a sense of momentum that is really, really wonderful. He also sees the long arc. After my audition for, they threw me in the pit at Sunday in the Park with George. They just threw me in the second half of the first act to watch me. And then Steve said, let's go get a drink across the street. And what I want to say is I don't drink, but I went and had a drink. he talked, we were talking and he said, at one point he said, you and Paul are yin and yang. Paul has an incredible overview and you have an incredible sense of detail. And I didn't take that as a compliment. I took that as a challenge. I have got to develop a larger picture. And I'll tell you one story because I love this moment and I wish I could tell it to him to his face right now. I conducted a full performance of in of Sunday in the Park while Paul watched it. And I came up afterwards, the only time he watched me, and I came up afterwards just before he was leaving the next day. And I said, oh God, I know I was a little late on that Q&A. And he said, shut up. It was fine. Every little thing that you know, you're going to fix it. I am not worried about it. It was great. I said, that's it? He says, yeah, you're going to be great. He started to walk off. And then this always reminds me of that moment in Columbo when the detective just was like, oh, one more thing. He turned to me and said, well, I do have one thing, but now you don't want, no, listen, forget it. It's silly. I said, no, tell me. He said, well, when I'm at this point, and he mentioned the moment after the day off, the dog song.
Yeah.
I think about this moment, which is the moment when George freezes everybody, ba-da-da-da-dum, right before he assembles the picture.
Yeah.
He says, to me, there's kind of like a line from there to there. And then he said, nah, forget it. And he walked away. And I went into the pit the next night. And when I got to that moment, I started thinking about how the first act was going to end. And like, it was like a chiropractic adjustment. It's like, suddenly the skeleton lined up. And I just went, that's just unbelievable. That kind of intuition, that kind of a note to someone, that's profound.
Yeah.
So I've never taken him for granted at all. And his friendship I've always valued, because I think that in certain ways he was absolutely the best there was.
Yeah.
In other ways, perhaps not. It's too big a job for everybody to be equally as good at all of it.
Yeah.
But boy, I had a lot to learn from him.
That's yeah. Story. But he liked you. I mean, it seems that he wouldn't take every younger musical director kind of under his wing like he did with you and only a couple of others.
We had known each other as colleagues. The thing about conductors is we tend to be lone wolves. We don't tend to congregate.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps fear that someone would bomb the place and all the conductors would die at the same time.
Then what are you gonna
do? We always
do?
Have to be in separate places. but we always talked. We always shared stories. We had once I hope he won't mind my saying this, we had a contest to decide who had the most silly stuff in their pit. So I have a rubber chicken. I said, I have a rubber chicken. You know, he just knew how to keep people happy and involved and focused and relaxed.
Yeah.
And so many of my peers are lovely, lovely people, and they get in the pit and they turn dark.
Yeah.
You know, and I learned early on that, and it's the advice I give to my students on my last day of theater conducting class. I said, don't conduct mad. It never helps. It's always horrible.
Yeah.
Keep looking forward. Remember what a lovely job this is. Remember what a lovely story you're telling, and then deal with it later. You know? And the other thing is that so many things that happen in the pit, which seem so microscopically important to you, don't necessarily translate back a couple of rows, and they're more important to you than they are to anybody else. Mm. Just tell the damn story and then fix
it. What do you think, you know, I mean, certainly now, you know, there's such a kind of like Sondheim renaissance on Broadway, and it doesn't seem to be slowing down. And, you know, it's safe to say that his shows will be kind of at the forefront of the canon, you know, at least for, you know, the near term. What do you think that the new generations putting them on are missing for not having had Sondheim in the process the way he was, certainly on the original productions, and really even for all the revivals of his lifetime?
Well, the thing is that his process has been so carefully documented by others, but also more importantly by himself. He has written extensively about what he learned from Oscar and what he took from that and made his own. I mean, those two coffee table books they're not coffee table books.
No.
They're literally primers.
I mean,
all you need to know is in there. I'm not sure that proximity is necessary at this point. I do know that I've always thought of him as the summation of the Golden Age rather than, you know, the absolute new thing.
Mm.
He was experimental. He broke so many rules. He stretched the form. He dragged the musical kicking and screaming into adulthood. You know, he celebrated ambivalence and human nature, the depths of human nature. We know all these things, but still in a certain ways, he's still the product of Hal and Abbott and Hammerstein. And you know, I mean, I was in rehearsal with him in that production at Promenade when I was in my 30s? And he turned to me and he said, you know, I really think that this guy should emphasize whatever, I forget what the note was, should not emphasize this syllable or emphasize that syllable. And I said, okay. He said, will you tell him or should I? And I went, Sondheim is asking me whether he give an actor a note. But the thing is, he grew up in the era where you wore a tie to rehearsal and there was a hierarchy. And
yeah,
the reason there was a hierarchy is because it worked better.
Right.
And he didn't want to be giving an actor a note at cross purposes to me.
Yeah.
I mean, again, there's so many ways where I think of him really as the last great old school writer in that way.
Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you so much for this, Eric. It is so great to get all this from you.
I hope you can use any of it.
Oh, God, almost all of it. Thank you for listening to Giants in the Sky, How Sondheim and Lapine Went Into the Woods on the Broadway Podcast Network. Look out for episode 55 with Robert McNeil, Jack on the National Tour.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.